We believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And now Tim's going to introduce our speaker tonight.
Thank you, Jackie.
I was changing back there. I don't want to oversell our speaker. Bill spoke about 4 or 5 months ago. We were in each other in Buford and blew my doors off. I'm telling you, I thought that since we get some folks in early recovery, some retreads, Bill's got a heck of a story. So, not to put too much pressure on you, but give us all you got, Bill. Come on, you can do it.
All right. Hey, everybody. I'm an alcoholic, and the problem is Bill Johnston. My sobriety date is August 13th, 2009. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I am actually sponsoring people right now. They can't be here because I don't know where one is, and the other one's at drug court. So all right, so I'll get started. I am born and raised in Atlanta, Buckhead community, but I quickly moved down to Little Five Points area. Let me back up. Put a little disclaimer. I identify myself as an alcoholic because alcohol and drugs, as it says, are but a symptom of our problems, and my problem is my thinking. So there is drugs in my story. I'll try to keep it as G-rated as possible, but everything that defines an alcoholic defines my mind and my way of thinking. And I found the solution here, so therefore I identify myself as an alcoholic. So I grew up in Atlanta, went to Atlanta Public High School, Atlanta Public Middle School, and from an early age, I always felt different. You know, I was never content with what I had or where I was at. Always wanted what the other person had. And then when I had that, I wanted something else. You know, I was never completely satisfied. You know, it says in the big book, if we could only get what we want and manage our lives the way we want it to be managed, that everything would be great. Well, I think we've all tried that, and it doesn't quite work. Because I got what I wanted most of the time, but it didn't make me happy. When I was in elementary school, my best friend got killed in a boating accident on Lake Lanier, and that kind of sent me into a little depression era, and my parents moved me to a private school, Galloway, if anybody knows what that is. Well, going from a public school to a private school is a rough transition, especially halfway through the year, because you don't know anybody, and you're that kid that just came from public school, so immediately you're outside all the groups. So I learned to not like anybody because nobody liked me. And I always want everybody to like me. Even if I don't like you and I don't want you to like me, you still better like me, because if you don't, it'll piss me off. So I stayed there, and then I got kicked out for being a delinquent, which is a reoccurring theme in my life. So I went back to public school. And after a year and a half in a private school of being the outcast, I kind of learned to fit the role. So I went back to public school. You know, I didn't go back with any of my old friends, because before I went to private school, I was, you know, fairly popular. I had a bunch of friends. You know, I would say I was like the most popular kid, but I was went in that circle. And then when I came back, I was like, you know, I had learned that I wasn't cool. So I just kept playing that role. And, you know, would get picked on and stuff, because I think I was like 110 pounds. I've always been really, really skinny. I got picked on a lot, and, you know, I learned it young, mostly from my sister, who was older, that when somebody picks on you, you do something back to hurt them, you know, normally physically, and if they're bigger than you, then, you know, hit them with something, you know. So I learned real young that, you know, if somebody makes fun of you and you pick up the baseball bat out of the field thing and you pop them in the side of the leg, they're going to not make fun of you. And most people aren't either. So I was like, okay, there's that solution to that problem. But it's really not a solution. So somewhere in early high school, freshman year, I started drinking, and it wasn't like that, yeah, this is great. It was like, okay, I don't have to be me when I drink. And that was pretty cool because my thought process changed, and I wasn't focused on who I am, where I'm at, or how bad life was. It was, let's get drunk and go out and do crazy stuff, which is normally what I did. You know, I didn't like being drunk, so I found things that allowed you to drink as much as you want and keep going, and that was really fun until the end of the night when everybody else was like, okay, I've had enough, and they wanted to go to sleep, and I'm like, sleep? What's that? And I wanted to keep going, you know, and after a day or two of that, it started sucking, so, you know, I found some high power sedatives over in the Bluff, and learned that you can drink a lot and do a lot of other stuff and then come down from it relatively quickly. And that was great, and nothing else mattered after that. I think the first time I did some of those high-powered sedatives that you can buy on the corner in the Bluff, my first words out of my mouth is, where can I get some more? Like, immediately it was like, yes. So nothing else mattered after that. Nothing at all. Didn't care about anybody, anyone, myself. And that became my life. And 2 weeks after I turned 18, I started getting arrested. Funny how I couldn't do it as a juvenile. But yeah, 2 weeks after my 18th birthday, I got arrested for the first time for, I don't know, APD just broke down pretty much everything they could and tried to figure out what could stick. So I went to court, and apparently it was out of jurisdiction when he arrested me. So I got thrown out. So I was like, woohoo. You know? So I learned that there's ways out of the repercussions in the Atlanta judicial system because they're not very good at their job, apparently. That was my thinking, you know. So I kept going. I kept, you know, when you're 18 years old and you have no job and you have to spend a couple hundred dollars a day on things to keep you going, you find ways to get it. And, you know, taking things that didn't belong to you was fairly easy and quick, and it worked. So I started doing that, and I like to think that I was pretty good at it, but the fact that I kept getting in trouble for it and arrested for it makes me now think that I wasn't, because if I was good at it, I would never have got caught. So I kept getting arrested, and, you know, call mom. Mom, you know, you wouldn't believe what happened. I was walking down the street, and this cop rolled up on me and arrested me for something that I had nothing to do with. And, you know, being the good codependent mom she was, I'd be out in a couple hours. And best thing about getting arrested in Fulton County is you get out of jail, they give you some cash. Well, this was back in the day, like late 90s. They give you cash that you came in with, and it was basically like you sat there for a couple hours and got a free ride to the Bluff. Because it's right across the street. So you get out, you walk across the street, and you're right back in the same scenario you were before you got arrested. And so one time I was in jail, and I was like, Mom. And she's like, I'll come bail you out, but you got to go to rehab. And I was like, okay. So I was like, I'll be out in about 6-8 hours, which, of course, it only took about 4. If anybody knows Fulton County Jail, it's giving them some credit. So I got out, ran across the street, got some dope, outside issues, came back, you know, sat in the lobby of the jail, wasted, and waited for Mom. And I went to a place called Narconon, which is out in Oklahoma. It's actually a Scientology-based rehab. Yeah, you said it. You know, I kind of believe that any type of treatment works as long as you work it, you know. It didn't work for me, but when I was there, we were about 15, 20 miles in the middle of cornfields in some Indian reservation, and I got with some other kids there. We decided we'd collect money from other people, and we'd walk to town and get some liquor and bring it back. So me being the brilliant leader that I am, I was like, yeah, I know how to get there. You know, I know how to read the sun and go in the right direction. Because, I mean, we were literally, it was like a 5 mile long driveway in the middle of cornfields. So this other guy was like, I'll go with you. And I was like, awesome. So I had my little cohort, and we're walking through cornfields. I had no clue where I was going, but I was like, it's that way, I'm telling you. And he believed me, and we kept walking, and some farmer on a tractor gave us a ride closer. It took us like 8 hours to walk to town. We got some liquor. We got a gallon of the cheapest vodka and a six-pack of beer. I think it was like $12 altogether. It was really nasty vodka. We hitchhiked a ride back because we were running late, and we had to, like, where they count everybody type thing, make sure you don't escape. And after that, we broke out the liquor, and of course, if you're sober for a little bit of time and you pass out a bunch of gut rot vodka to a bunch of kids, they walk around pretty stupid. And I was no different. And we got caught, and I got kicked out, which is another recurring theme. I went back a couple weeks later, and I did it, and they were like, well, we're so proud of you, why don't you stay here and work? I was like, all right. So I stayed there and worked as a detox counselor for about 8 months, which I had no clue what I was doing. But they paid me, gave me a place to live, free room and board, stuff like that. But I was stuck in Oklahoma, and I got sick and tired of hailing to a picture of L. Ron Hubbard, which is something that you did. So, yeah. So I quit believing it, and then, of course, you know, best place to find a girlfriend's in rehab. So, who just came into rehab because I worked at a detox center, so she was in there dope sick, and I was like, oh, it'll be all right. And, you know, the detox sparks flew, and so I decided, let's leave here together. And she was from Chicago, so we went back to Atlanta, and she liked the same high-power sedatives that I did, so that was great. So about 2 or 3 weeks, we were back in the same situation I was before, and we figured we'd move to Chicago to get away from it. Apparently, Chicago has high-power sedatives of their own, and it's pretty good. So, you know, that got really bad up there, and so I figured it would be better if we got married, you know? That would solve the problem. So I lit a couple candles, asked her to marry me. She said yes, and you know, her dad wasn't too thrilled because we were still living in their house. So come the wedding day, we were like, you know, we're not going to do this sober. But the problem was she had on a wedding gown, right? It didn't have any pockets. Well, she wasn't about to give me the needles because she kept those and I kept the dope. That way we couldn't cheat each other. So, you know. So I started off my marriage great. She's walking down the aisle with a couple needles in her garter belt. And I'm thinking, I hope those don't fall out. You know, I had my dope in pocket. And the only thing I could think of was, this needs to hurry up. I need to get wasted. So that is definitely a firm foundation for matrimony. I think it got annulled after 8 months. So I carried her through the little door, turned right into the hotel bathroom, set her down, and don't remember too much after that. Yeah, I do, but you don't need to know about it. So we moved back to Atlanta because it got bad up there. So we're, you know, changing location again. And, of course, that doesn't work because we're still the same mind frame, just in a different city. And getting wasted. And we meet up with some guy. He liked to smoke cocaine. And one day, because our car broke down, so we're riding around with this guy we met on the street corner. Over off Bankhead somewhere. I don't know. So he was like, great. He'd drive us around. I'd go in and steal stuff. We'd make money, give him a little bit. One day he goes into a hotel room with somebody, and we're sitting in the car, and I'm like, hey, the keys are in there. Why don't we have to pay him anymore? So we just drive off in his car, you know? Have not had a chance to make amends for that one, because all I know his name is Tony. But I hope he's doing okay. If I do see him, I will make amends for that. He did get his car back, as you will about to find out. So we're sitting by MLK in Ashby area, somewhere in there. And a stolen car that's been stolen for like 2 weeks. Don't know what we're doing, but I know we had a bunch of stolen stuff in the trunk. And cops roll up. Of course, they run the tag because, you know, just the way we looked, I guess. I would have run my own tag, too, if I was them, so I can't really blame them. So they take us to jail. And, yeah, this time it was just for a stolen car, but I had been running the streets for so long, living in a car and stuff, that I got, like, pneumonia really bad and some other respiratory things from just pretty much being a junkie on the streets. So they were like, you need to go to Grady because we can't take you to jail. So I'm in Grady, so I'm sitting on the bed, and this person comes and is like, hey, you know, I gave him a fake name too, I think, yeah. This person comes and says, you're not who you say you are. You're so-and-so, and you have a warrant out of Minnesota for manslaughter. And I was like, wait, what? So, I didn't do that one, actually. But I decided that I shouldn't be locked up, so I figured I'd escape. So, I went and disassembled the sink and talked to the officer into releasing my shackles, and I tried to do one of those Hollywood things where you just hit them over the head one time real quick, and they just, like, pass out. Okay, it doesn't work like it does in the movies. You hit somebody over the head with something heavy, they start screaming. Then you hit them two or more, three more times, and all I do is scream louder. So that was after I'd been in the hospital for about 2 days on a morphine drip. And so I was a little crazy. So I ran out the door, picked up the walkie-talkie, hit the elevator button, the doors opened right up. And there's an elevator full of people in the hospital at Grady. You know, wouldn't you know it? And they're all like, oh, because, you know, I've been sitting in a hospital bed for a couple days. My hair is all crazy. I didn't know it, but I had blood splattered across my face. I'm holding a pipe and a radio, just screaming bloody hell. So I get in the elevator. I'm like, ground four, please. And somebody's like, please. So I was like, wait a minute. No, one. So I get off on the first floor, run to the other side of the hospital, run out the door. You know, I'm in a hospital gown, you know, and socks. By now, I've gotten rid of the pipe and the walkie-talkie, and so I'm just walking up the street, you know, that hill right by the McDonald's. Like, yeah, I'm supposed to be here. And a security guard in, like, a 1982 Honda Civic, you know, tries to pull me over. I'm like, really? So I take off running. Next thing I know, I got, like, Georgia State University Police, Fulton County Sheriff's, Atlanta Police, building authorities, Fulton County Marshals. They're all, like, chasing me down the street. They had me on a lot of morphine because of my addiction and in order to keep me, like, normal. So I go into a revolving door. Yeah, I grew up watching Looney Tunes. So I go in a revolving door, and this is not a lie. And I try to do one of those spin-around revolving door things, hoping they're all in it because it was, like, a really big revolving door. It was, like, you know, the size of that group of chairs. And so I get about three-quarters of the way around, and I realize there's, like, still a bunch of them out there because there was, like, you know, 20 or 30 of them chasing me. So I stopped the elevator. All the doors collapsed around me, and so I'm like, all right. So I make a push one way and then change directions and go out the door. I actually make it through the line of officers, and I run and I jump over this bush, and, you know, the sidewalk went straight, but the street kind of went down at a 45-degree angle. So I jump over this bush, and then there's nothing on the other side except for this really big Fulton County sheriff who just, like, catches me in the air, body slams me and hog ties me and takes me to jail. So I go to court for that one about a year later, and I had this, you know, guy who's like, I'm your public defender. You're my first case. This should be really fun. And he's like, I'm going to get you probation. I'm like, awesome, you know. Something happened to him, and about 15 public defenders later, I go to court and I got probation. But they lost my paperwork. Wouldn't you know it, Fulton County losing paperwork. So they resent me for a week later. 2 days later, Brian Nichols shot my judge. Yeah. So now I got to reset, get a new judge who did not like anything violent against a law enforcement officer. And so, in his words, in lieu of recent events, I can't in good conscience take your plea of probation. So he sent me to prison for 4 years. Yeah. And first time in prison, it was different, you know. It was a lot better than the 7th, 6th floor of Fulton County Jail. I drank a lot of coffee, played poker, played sports. It's kind of like summer camp from hell, you know. They sent me to one of those medium security work camps, you know. I already knew how to weld, so they put me to work as a welder in the fabrication thing. It's a place called Walker State Prison up by Chattanooga, up northwest Georgia. And it was pretty laid back. And then I called my sister, and she's like, you know, when you get out, you come here, but you should try this thing called AA. And I'm like, all right, you know, I'll give it a shot. Yeah, whatever. You know, just trying to appease my sister, who... My sister has pretty much the same story as I do, except for she never did anything injectable and or any of the sedative parts. She liked to stay awake, which I couldn't get. But she had like 4 years in the program at that time. She's still sober. So I'm like, okay, whatever. And she's like, you need to get a sponsor too. I was like, what? So I get out and I do that. And, you know, I'm going to get a little controversial here. I take the advice of don't drink and go to meetings. So that's pretty much all I did. And that was bad advice. Somebody should have said, don't drink, go to meetings, get a sponsor, and actually work the steps. That's some good advice. Because if you just don't drink and go to meetings, you're just pretty much not drinking and talking to girls outside a meeting, playing on your phone, thinking about what you're going to do later, and... Wait, was those things on the wall? Oh, yeah, those things. This is just wall decoration. Again, I find a girlfriend, you know. This one's actually an active addiction when I've met her. But she liked me enough to stop. So she did, started coming to meetings. And, you know, I didn't have a sponsor. I did have a sponsor. He was in my phone. You know, that was about it. I think I worked step one, kind of. You know, I knew my life was unmanageable. That was about it. So we started, you know, injecting high-power sedatives in the Bluff again. And she got a job at Pink Pony. So, you know. But then that wasn't enough money. You know, $1,000 a night, that was gone the next day. How we did that, I have no clue. But we managed to do it. So she would go to work, and I'd go out and I'd start stealing stuff again. And then she got fired, so now we were on our own. So I went back to the old habits of taking things that didn't belong to me. And, you know, started doing robberies and doing them in places where I shouldn't be doing them, like, you know, those counties that actually have good law enforcement, like Gwinnett and Cherokee and places like that where, you know, 120-pound strung-out junkie kind of sticks out, you know. You know, fit in downtown Atlanta, but out there, they're like, who are you? We're calling the police because we don't even know what you're doing. So she got pregnant. Yeah. And we got engaged because that was going to fix everything. But then one day, you know, we're on the news for robbery string in Atlanta. And she went off to rehab because we had gotten arrested for something else in Fulton. And they didn't realize who we were, so they let us out because Fulton is just really thorough in their checking. So she got out and went to rehab. I got out like a day later, and everybody's like, you know, you're on the news. They're looking for you. So I had a fugitive task force looking for me, and they're on the phone with me. And I'm like, catch me if you can. And then for like 3 days, it just progressively got worse and worse and worse. My car stopped running because I ran through a barricade. And it got really, really bad. So I'm going to read something out of the big book that accurately describes it. I was really nervous coming here, so I forgot my big book, so I was so worried about trying to find a tie. But yeah, it's out of the chapter of Vision for You. And this pretty much sums up how I felt. The less people tolerate us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself. As we became subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm, the chilling vapor that his loneliness settled down, it thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. Momentarily, we did. Then would come the oblivion of the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. I was sorry in that. It was so bad, you know. I just couldn't. I was like, I hope they show up here to arrest me and they shoot me. Because I didn't want to go on. It got so bad. I'm pretty sure most of y'all know what it's like. You know, those last days when you're like, fucking just kill me. Please. I don't want to do this anymore. But you keep doing it anyway. Why? Anybody got a good reason? Anybody? No. I don't know why either. But I did it. And I did it like till the wheels fell off, literally. I'm the type of person who, I don't like to get wasted. I like to get so fucked up. I lose control of my body and my mind. You know, balls to the wall. You know. Here, try this piece of acid. No, I'll eat that whole pin strip. Just for fun. You know, stuff like that. So, I gave up. I worked step one while I was wasted, you know. I can't control my using, drinking, anything outside. And when I do it, my life becomes completely unmanageable. So I called that fugitive task force guy and I was like, look, you got to come get me or I'm going to die. And my friend drove me to the Gwinnett County police station and I turned myself in because it was that bad. I couldn't take it anymore. Somebody else had to take over. Which is really weird because I really don't like law enforcement. Like now, you know, we've reached an understanding. You know, I don't mess with them. They don't mess with me. But back then, I hated them. You know, they were like the enemy of the world. I used to go out to do things to cop cars when nobody was around. You know, make sure they didn't work. You know, drain the oil, sugar in the gas tank, stuff like that. So I go to jail. And we're looking at a couple different robberies in a couple different counties. And fiance at the time, pregnant. And I tell a big lie to the DA and do everything I can to get her out of trouble. And they were going to let me go with, you know, time served probation. And I was like, but what are you going to do for her? Because I'm like the good protector type person. And they were like, well, you know, nothing really. So finally it got to the point where, like, you know, if you don't tell us where she is, we're going to give you 10 years. And I was like, well, okay, right. I'm not going to tell her. And so they're like, all right, have fun in trial. So I went in front of the judge, and I was like, you know, I forced her to do it. And so they gave me 10 years, sir, 4. 4 is my lucky number for going to prison. So I take a 10 to 4, and a couple months later I find out that she's engaged to my best friend, and that's his kid. So there I am, sitting in prison with all this on my head. And it was so bad that day I turned myself in. I was like, I can't live like this anymore. You know, I think I was 28, 29. No, I was like 30. Yeah, I was like 30 when that happened. So I'm in jail. And I call a friend, and I ask him to sponsor me. And he starts coming to visit me in jail twice a week for 30 minutes a day. He would bring a friend of his from the program or somebody that I knew. And through that little plastic window, you know, he'd bring a big book. He mailed me a big book. Before he mailed me one, they had big books in the jail library you can read. You know, when they ask for donations for corrections literature, sometimes people actually do read those. So we started doing step work in county jail. I did step one on my own. I didn't need a sponsor to know that I was powerless and my life had become unmanageable. That pretty much pretty much was obvious. So we started working the steps, 30 minutes at a time, twice a week. I did my 4-step pretty fast because I didn't have very much to do, you know, sitting in a room by myself with the door locked. So I was kind of, it's kind of fun, you know, I had something to do finally while I was sitting in jail. 5th step, I think it took somewhere between 6 and 8 months to go through it because it was pretty big. You know, like I said, 30 minutes twice a week to do a 5th step. It took a long time. And sometimes he'd bring somebody with him, and I'd have no choice. I needed to do it. So I did it with my sponsor and some random person from the program that came with him. And it was kind of cool because not only did I get my sponsor's spirit, strength, and hope when I was sharing my 5th step, I got some random person who didn't know my story from anywhere and could relate to exactly the things that I was doing. And I did all the steps except for asking God to remove my shortcomings. Because by the time I got there, they sent me to prison, and I messed up and told them I was a welder this time. And the Georgia Department of Corrections was undergoing renovations in the HIMAX facilities, and they needed somebody to do the welding. So they sent me to really fucked up prisons. Places like Augusta State Prison, Valdosta, Hayes. And, you know, I think at that time I was like 140 pounds. Smartass, because I'm a smartass. And pretty much the only thing I had going for me was, you know, I'd walk in the dorm and we had cell phones in prison. You know, people and bring them in. And my sister referred to it. Are you calling me from the ass phone? So when somebody new walked in the door, they'd be like, who are you? Where are you from? And they'd get your ID number and they'd get on their phone and they'd check and see what your charges were. Because if you were in there for child molestation or something crazy like that, they didn't want you in the dorm. And then the next day they'd ask you, where are you from? And I'd be like, oh, I'm Bill. I'm from Atlanta. What's up? You know? And they're like, who you know? And I was like, so I started naming off some drug dealers from the bluff. And, oh, that's my cousin. Cool. And, you know, they'd call him, be like, hey, you know this guy? And kind of like verify the other prisoners. It's kind of funny. So, you know, so I'm in there and I work in the maintenance department, so I have access to metal. And, you know, there's gangs in prison that don't like each other very much, and they're always looking for ways to do stuff to the other gang, so I started supplying weapons for one gang, and, you know, that worked out pretty good for me because I didn't get messed with. Most other people got, you know, beat up, stuff stolen. You know, I just made weapons, and they kept me from bad stuff happening to me. It was pretty messed up on my part, but, you know, I watched other people, you know. I grew up in Atlanta. I'm not racist, but I know when I'm the only white guy in a room, you know. And I know when I'm the only one in a room that's going to leave prison alive. I shared a shell with Wayne Williams for 6 weeks. Anybody know who Wayne Williams is?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You know, most people in my dorm were doing multiple life sentences plus like 80,000 years because Georgia loves to hand out prison time, you know. I mean, how are you going to do one life sentence, let alone 8? So, you know, everybody there was going to die in prison except for me. And when you're around a bunch of people who are going to die in prison, they really don't have anything to lose because if you kill somebody in prison, you got a life sentence. They don't even take you to court anymore because it's just waste tax dollars. You know, and just throw you in the hole for a couple weeks, let you out. Don't do that again, please. You know, so I had to survive and, you know, I used my defects of character to keep me alive in there. It kind of sucked. But I remember the day I was getting out, I'm walking down the little, you know, the little sidewalk and you get to these couple gates that you got to walk through before you can get out. And I'm getting a guard escort, and I get to that last gate. And I drop down on my knees, and I ask God to remove my defects of character. And that prisoner was like, what are you doing? And he goes, I'm like, I'm about to go live life the right way. So as I'm walking out of there, I ask God to remove my shortcomings. I made a prayer before I left prison, and my sponsor picked me up, took me to Waffle House, because that's where I wanted to go, because I was sick of eating grits and collard greens. and beans and rice. So that's about all you got in there. The comparison of the two times that I went to prison the first time, I said it was summer camp from hell. You know, this last time, you can't buy cigarettes anymore, so everything's smuggled in. And it's like, you know, $2 for a little roll-up cigarette. It was kind of crappy. It changed. It was horrible. You know, it was, you know, it was really bad. I saw some things in there that just crazy. When I was at Augusta, I was in probably one of the worst dorms. And I swear from that prison, I'd walk to the maintenance shed, and every morning, there, 5 out of 7 days, there'd be a corner van in front of it. Because people, you know, they're killing each other. You know, they don't care. You know, they don't care at all. And I cared. I didn't want to die in prison. So I get out, and I start working the steps again. I did them with my sponsor fairly fast, because I did them before. First day, I went to a meeting. I got out on a Tuesday, January 31st. I went to a meeting, and the next day I went and saw my parole officer, who didn't want me out past 7. I was like, well, that's going to be a problem, because these AA meetings are at 8. And he let me stay out, and in fact, he had me on the ankle monitor, and I bothered him so much about changing my schedule so I could go to different meetings that he finally said, look, come in here. I know you're doing the right thing. And he cut off my ankle monitor like a couple months early. He was like, you quit bothering me. And I'd call him all the time and be like, hey, is it okay if I go do this, you know, AA function down in Atlanta? I'll be gone for a night. And he'd be like, quit calling me. You're bothering me, you know? You know, you're not the type of person that I want phone calls from. You know, I'm looking for the people who screw it up. And I got a job as a welder. And I started doing the meetings. Now I want to reread something. It's in the promises, actually. It says, if we're painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. If I put enough effort, if I put half the amount of effort into working a program that I put into finding drugs, I'd be sober. I'd like to think I put a little bit more than half. I know I don't put as much effort into staying sober as I did for drugs because, you know, that was like 130% of my effort. But it's true, you know. If you work steps with a sponsor who's worked the steps before and you actually try, you will be amazed before you're halfway through. Today I know a new freedom and a new happiness. You know, I don't wake up worrying about how I'm going to survive the morning, let alone the day. You know, I live 1 hour at a time. Like, how am I going to get high this hour? And then that hour be gone. How am I going to get messed up the next hour? And no matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will show how our experience can benefit others. I'm thinking I went pretty far down the scale. I spent almost a decade locked up. And I'm 35. Spent a decade locked up. Now, that's a lot of life to miss. And it's my fault, you know. The choices that I made. Had I not been, you know, wasted, I probably wouldn't have made those mistakes. You know, I don't know too many sober people who go out and rob stuff. You know, there are, but there's not very many, you know. The feelingness of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. You know, when you're sitting on the couch, or when I'm sitting on the couch at least, just obliviated, you know, not knowing which way is up, not knowing which way is down, I'm useless. I know I'm useless. And I'm thinking to myself, why is this happening to me? How can I not get sober? You know, and I'd want to get sober. You know, I had that gift of desperation. I'm pretty sure I had that gift of desperation every day. But that wasn't enough. You know. And then it goes on and it says those will disappear. You know. I'm not useless today. I know I'm not. You know, I'm a tool of God. And I try to do that as much as possible. I still make mistakes. You know. I think we all do. Self-seeking will slip away. I'm still fairly selfish. I'll admit it. You know, I think most of us are. I don't think anybody's totally unselfish in everything they do. If you are, then congratulations. Please see me after the meeting and let me know how you are doing it. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. You know, I looked at life totally different than I did before. It wasn't like, if I was an active addiction and I walked in this room, I would try to size up which one of y'all had the purse with the most money, and then which one of y'all was fast to try to avoid you. You know? That's how I live life. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. I was always in fear. I lived in fear. My whole life was fear. I was afraid of myself. I was afraid of my mind. I was afraid of police, people, cars, horns, grasshoppers, butterflies. I didn't care. I was afraid of everything. Fear ruled my life. You know? And it's funny, you know, I'm not afraid to go up and get in a fight with someone who's like 6'3", 240 pounds. That type of fear doesn't bother me, you know. It's the fear in here that scares the living crap out of me. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Yeah. We intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. You know, I still don't know how to handle situations sometimes. But I know how not to handle them. You know. I hear all the time, you know, just do the next right thing. Well, what if either action you take is the next right thing? Could be deemed as the next right thing. So I kind of modified that. I did the next thing right. You know, no matter what I do, I try to do my best. I read a book. It's called The Four Agreements. It's not AA-approved literature. It's called The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz. And that's some pretty interesting stuff. And most of the stuff actually went hand in hand with AA literature. And one of them was always do your best, you know. No matter what it is, always do your best at it. Today my best may be par. Tomorrow my best may be way above par. Yesterday my best was below par. But as long as I did my best at whatever I do, I'm generally happy with myself as the outcome. You know, sometimes I really fuck up. You know, sorry to curse. I don't know how y'all are about that here, but I am like a sailor. Yeah, I screw up bad, you know, and I call people as soon as I do it. Normally him. And he's like, you know, well, what'd you learn from it? You know, learn from your mistakes. Because if you make mistakes and then I can identify that I made a mistake, I may not make that mistake again. Or if I do, it won't be as bad as the first one. And then the third one won't be as bad as the second one. But normally I get out of the habit of making that mistake when the pain's bad enough. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. You know, I hear people share, it's only through the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous that I'm here today. I hear people open up like that all the time. And it is a miracle. I mean, it has to be God that, you know, A, I chose to turn myself in, because that's completely against my nature. B, that I made it all those years, you know, of, well, let's do this much because I think it might kill me. And no, it just got me really high, you know. Wake up with Grady. Just got a heart full of whatever that stuff is they give you when you die. And I'd be mad at the doctor. I'm like, what'd you do that for? You ruined my high. And I'd leave and do it again. I relate to that story in the big book of the jaywalker. You know, he walks across the street, gets hit by a car, does it again, gets hit by a car, does it again, goes to the hospital, gets like totally smashed up body, and, you know, rolls his wheelchair out in front of traffic and gets hit by a truck. You know, that's me. You know, I will continuously do the same stuff over and over and over again. And I've done that my whole life. And the results are always the same. Like, how many times do I have to hit my head against the wall before I realize it hurts? And it was only through divine intervention, you know, that I realized to stop. So it took me coming to terms with a higher power, you know, God, whatever you want to call it, whatever works for you. If you don't have one, it'd probably be a good suggestion to find one. If you can't, you can borrow mine. You can call them Gods of Bill's Understanding. Are these extravagant promises? No. They're being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes me. You know, it took a while. I don't know when. You know, I didn't have some spiritual experience. You know, the clouds didn't part, the face of God didn't appear, and be like, you! You know, that didn't happen for me, you know. I don't know what day it was that I was like, the obsession was gone. I couldn't tell you it happened on March 31st. One day I realized, hey, I don't think about this anymore. Wait a minute, how long have I not been thinking about this for? And it was apparently a while. Today it's not even part of my life. I don't think about it, you know, ever. The only time I think about drinking is during a meeting. You know, go figure that one, you know. When I talk about the hopeless state of mind and body that I used to be in. But for the rest of the 23 hours in the day, drinking, drugs, you know, robbing folks, that stuff never crosses my mind. How? I mean, that was definitely learned behavior. I have no clue how it happened. Actually, I know exactly how it happened. I got a sponsor who works 12 steps. I actually work the 12 steps that are posted on the wall. You know, I pray, I meditate. I didn't used to pray. My prayer started like once a week and twice a week and three times a week. Then once in the morning, once at night. And then pretty soon it was like I'm doing it every day. And I actually saw a difference. If I don't pray for a couple days, I can feel it a couple days later. Like how I work my program today affects me not only right now, but in the next few days. You know, they say a relapse happens 2 weeks before it actually happens. Those are the 2 weeks we stop, or I stop practicing the principles in all my life, you know. And this is the most important line. They will always materialize if we work for them. You know, if you just show up, it's not going to happen, you know. I got to do something to get something back. And I do get something back. I get to give it to other people. I love working with my sponsee. You know, he is a mess. He's not in here, is he? No, okay. He is a mess. And I'm taking him through the steps, but I'm doing, you know, a sponsor's job, as I was told, is just to work somebody through the steps. We don't have to go pick him up and take him to meetings. We don't have to coach him in all his other life problems, you know. We don't have to take him to work with us and have him sweep the floor and give him $50 for doing it because he doesn't have a job, you know. I do those type of things because I feel like I have to. Because somebody did it for me. Somebody came to visit me in jail twice a week for 18 months, 30 minutes a day. And that was like an hour there, half hour away, and an hour home. So he spent 3 hours twice a week to come see me because I couldn't live life as a junkie. You know, I couldn't do dope like a gentleman. And I've always asked myself, I was like, you know, what can I do to repay? You know, when I went to make amends to him for sending me a couple $100 a month when I was in prison. You know, driving to South Georgia to work some more steps with me in visitation in prison. You know, and he was like, do it for your sponsee. You know, that's how you make it back to me. And if y'all are in treatment, when I was in treatment, I was like, you know, playing ping pong, hanging out, playing cards. What am I supposed to be doing, Mr. Supervisor? And what I should have been doing was reading the big book, talking to other alcoholics, and actually trying to work the steps, you know. I forgot to mention, I went to like 8 different treatment centers and got kicked out for getting high. Yeah, something like that. While I was there, I never did any work. You know, that's when I should have been reading the big book, working with others, learning the 12 steps, and trying to practice. And today, life is good. And that's all I got. Thank you.
Bill. thank you so much. That was amazing. And I want to know when they're going to make a movie. I'm serious. Like, that's the best story ever.